Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Oh, Miles here.
Your outpost for the week is freshly delivered, and I am just one of the hosts here, Matthew Rushing, but with me, as she is always, the enigma among enigmas, the greatness among great, Drea Goffman.
Hello! I'm having a unicorn sort of week, so that all fit very nicely in there.
A unicorn? Okay, but what does that even mean?
You know, you're unique and special and sparkle, and you know, no one messes with a unicorn except for maybe Voldemort.
True.
But you know, he's nuts. So,
yeah, absolutely. I mean, don't mess with unicorns, folks.
Little life lesson there.
As Hagrid would say, you'll live a cursed life,
a half life.
So, yeah. Absolutely. But no, we're excited to be back. We get chapter 15 of The Goblet of Fire, Bobatons and Drumstrang. So we're about to dive in. But before we do that, of course, you can find us everywhere. Make sure that you check us out on Twitter at Join Nerd Party. Make sure you're following us there. And of course, we're over on Facebook, facebook.com/TheNerdParty. Make sure you're liking us, checking us out, making sure that you're, you know, talking to us when we post our shows there. Of course, also, you can find us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, either one, which is a great place to give us a star rating review and help people know what you like about the show. It also helps other people find the show when they're searching for us in iTunes. Of course, you can find us wherever you get your podcasts. And then last but not least, thenerdparty.com, where you can find all of the shows that we do here in the network. And if you'd like to send us an email, you can go over to thenerdparty.com/contact. You can choose a show and choose Outpost, and then Dre and I will get that email, and we'll be able to talk to you that way. So this is, I would say, a very interesting chapter. There's a lot of things that I feel like kind of happen in it, because we are preparing for the coming of these two new schools. But before we get to any of that, we just talked about last week how Harry, not happy with Sirius, and not happy with the response he got from Sirius. So he wakes up early the very next morning and scribbles off a note to Sirius to tell him, no, he's fine, everything's fine, we're all fine, how are you, basically. And sends it off.
Everything's fine, nothing's on fire.
Oh, man. And I love that he does that because, you know, I think, again, it really does. It reinforces what we talked about last week, Harry's feeling about his godfather and feeling this responsibility for not wanting to put him in danger. And so I think it's just, it is to me fascinating to watch Harry struggle with that as a character. When you think about the fact that he doesn't really have family and this is his last family. And so, and then, of course, it also was fascinating to me to see, you know, he tells Ron and Hermione what he did, which I thought was interesting that he told them in the first place. And Hermione's like, but it's a lie. And Ron's just like, drop it, Hermione. And I wanted to ask you, because it really stood out to me, why do you think that Ron was so sharp with Hermione there? Do you think it's because he senses this in Harry, that the struggle that Harry's having? Or what is it? Because it's a very interesting moment to me to watch her. I mean, Ron literally, and she even writes it, Ron said sharply, drop it, Hermione. And it's like, oh, wow, Ron getting forceful. He doesn't usually get forceful like that.
I think it's a good sign of maybe just the relationship that Harry and Ron have that maybe Hermione doesn't really get to be a part of much, mostly because, you know, Ron and Harry get to spend a lot of time together in the Burrows and things like that. And I think he truly knows that it's tough for Harry to not have family. And I think that he understands that that's maybe something Hermione doesn't really comprehend. And so he kind of knows that it's just that Harry would probably never say anything like, oh, that makes me uncomfortable. But he knows like talking about his scar and his family is not Harry's favorite pastime. So, you know, I think he's just trying to kind of protect him a little bit in the only way he knows how. But yeah, it kind of stands out, right? Because there isn't really a lot of context for why. But yeah, I think it's just kind of a testament to, you know, he knows what Harry is sensitive to and he is trying to help support where he can, which he doesn't always get the opportunity to do. So it's kind of nice. But
well, and it's interesting, too, because again, the way she describes it, she says that Hermione heeded him for once and fell silent. And I just it's almost like that moment. Ron getting on Hermione about this, it's almost as if she realizes whatever it is that Ron's trying to convey, and Harry, the feeling that Harry's having. And what I think it created to me was that depth, that there's a lot going on in the inner working of these characters and their minds, but also just in their interplay towards each other. And this just seemed like one of those, it doesn't seem like a moment that would have been able to happen in one of the earlier books. This really does seem like something that has come about because they are older now and they do obviously know each other better. But it just seems like a bit of maturity from Ron here. And, you know, Ron really gets the shaft in the movies. So I just feel like this is one of those moments where Ron has a kind of a standout moment of coming to the defense of his friend with another friend and just finding a way to kind of help almost protect him. Because, yeah, I think you're right. He just senses this is not easy for Harry to deal with. And I don't know. It's just interesting to me.
I had a leader a long time ago who told me once that the most effective way to be in a meeting, which I both agree and disagree with in this case, but that the way to have the greatest effect when you're in a meeting is to wait, listen, and only speak up when you have something very important to say, and to only speak up when, you know, what you have to say adds a significant amount of value, because then your voice has a greater impact because you're not always talking. You're not always speaking. And people know that when you speak, you have something important to say. And I feel a little bit like that's happening here with Ron, is that he's not always sharp with Hermione. You know, like Hermione's always kind of sharp with people. Hermione's always kind of, if you will, a nag. You know, she's always got an opinion and advice to help and a thought on that. She's always read a book on that. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think in this moment, Ron was able to get her to listen because he doesn't do that often, because he doesn't speak sharply, because he doesn't speak up, and he's not so to the point as often as he, you know, he doesn't do it much. So for him to tell her to like, was like, okay, he must really mean it. There must really be a reason, which is also trust, right? She knows him well enough to know this is out of character for him, and she's just going to trust and let it go. So I agree. I think it's just, you know, character development. It's real relationship building. It just shows the depth of their relationship among each other, that even if she doesn't know, she's willing to sort of trust and let it go. And, you know, Ron uses his voice when he needs to.
I also thought that something that was fascinating here is how much the fourth year has changed just in terms of school. And it's because they are being given much more work to do. And they're being quizzed much more harshly, it seems like. And we find out, and I'm going to jump a little bit around in the chapter because it connects, but
you're not allowed to do that.
But
just kidding.
It's because we find out from McGonagall, it's all about the owls that are coming up the next year. And so the whole point of the fourth year is to prepare you for taking your owls in the fifth year and making sure that you're ready. And I just thought that that was a really interesting thing to see. You know, it's kind of like they've almost made the jump from like sort of like junior high to high school now, and like things have gotten a lot more serious. and serious. So Harry Potter humor. But I think, you know, that's
sorry, I'm still laughing about it now. Still laughing. It's a slow burn, guys. It's a slow burn.
But it is very interesting to watch them have so much more work on their plates this term and this year, and really be challenged in their education to ramp them up to what they're going to be doing the next year. You know, basically, it's like they're SATs almost. You know, that's kind of the thought process that I get. This is the first really big measurement of who they're going to be as witches and wizards. You know, so if you don't,
this is their first AP test, guys.
Yeah, if you don't do well on the owls, it's going to be very difficult for you. So, I just thought that was kind of a fascinating thing to see how this fourth year, there's so much that's changed, and one of them is just the fact that they've got a buttload of work compared to what they have had before. Like, it's just a much harder year for them.
Just imagine if we still had Hermione taking double classes because she still was using the time turner. I mean, yeah. Holy moly.
Yeah.
She couldn't run SPEW if that was the case. I'm sorry, SPEW. Forgive me, Hermione.
No, you're absolutely right. She wouldn't be able to. And it is fascinating to me. It's just nice. Like, Rowling has really found a way to just kind of differentiate each of the books, and this is a way to do that. And then part of that as well is that for Defense Against the Dark Arts, Moody has really been putting them through the paces, and he does something that we don't see in the movie, and I think this is fascinating, is he puts them through the Imperius Curse to see what it's like, to know what they're up against, and to try and learn how to fight through it. And this is something that I just think is so cool to read.
Yeah, I feel like it would be difficult to convey in a movie, so I get why you left it out, but it is so cool, and I wish there was a way to have done it, because it would be so neat. And it really, we don't get a lot of it in the movie at all throughout the entire series, but it really speaks to Harry's sort of natural talents, right? Like, they always kind of say, oh, Harry, you're a natural, right? And in the movies, a lot of that sort of gets chalked up to the fact that, I can't say that without ruining everything. Yeah. A lot of it gets chalked up to circumstance later on.
Yeah.
But in this case, you know, it sort of is just unintentional. And he goes in and he's just like, why would I jump on the desk? Wait, why am I doing that? I don't want to jump on the desk. And then he wakes up and he's like, I sort of half jumped on the desk.
Yeah.
You know, and that really speaks to his natural talent to be able just to think clearly through the curse. And, you know, Moody puts him through it a couple times until he totally can shake it and not follow. And, you know, that's a big deal. And they make it into a little bit of a big deal, but I don't know that the kids really understand that this is a big deal. And it really, again, speaks to the sort of natural wizarding talent that Harry has that he doesn't really get credit for in the movies. And we're only kind of seeing it here in the books. So it's really a really neat, like, concept of what's happening. Plus, it gives us more of Moody, which, you know,
Who
doesn't love a quirky old glass-eyed, magical-eyed character?
Well, and the fact that he's putting them through these paces in the first place, it's not normal, obviously, that, you know, Hermione even talks about how this is not done. And he's like, if you don't want to do it, fine, then leave. You know, like, he just gives her the choice. Yeah, you can walk out the door. It's cool. And she doesn't, of course, because she doesn't want to miss a lesson. But when we think about it, too, so Harry can do a Patronus, which is advanced wizarding magic beyond the third year for sure. And even, you know, there are even, you know, fifth, sixth, seventh years that can't necessarily do it either. So he's been able to do that. And now to be able to have the ability to shake off the Imperius Curse. Like, I love the way they describe it. Like, Harry says, it's this wonderful floating sensation, and it feels wonderful, and there's, like, happiness. Like, it feels, to him, there's this sense of, like, it's almost like he's transformed himself into Nirvana almost, you know?
He's just sort of like cloudy and foggy headed and, you know, he's just like not really aware of what's going on, which is kind of different than it's sold to us when it's being explained, right? It's like, it's like there is no awareness. It's sort of the explanation that we get from them earlier on. So for him to even sort of be able to think through it is kind of a cool thing. So it's really an interesting, really an interesting mechanism and a thing to explore early on.
Well, and I love how Harry's coming out of the class and he's kind of like hobbling because he's had these moments where, you know, his mind is telling him one thing and then his other part of his mind is telling him another thing and then his body half does it. It kind of hurts. You know, he's just walking out. He's like, man, you'd think the way he talks, we were going to be attacked any second. Like, I think that is kind of funny, but I think you're absolutely right. It's fascinating to me that they don't really give... They make a big deal of it, and Moody makes a big deal of what Harry's able to do, but it's going to be interesting to see how that may play out in the rest of the book.
I don't know, Matthew. Constant vigilance, guys. Constant vigilance.
I mean, it's actually good advice. Let's be honest. So, one of the funnier things that happens too is that they get top marks in divination. For their star charts.
For their made-up crap.
Ron and Harry are just like, oh, crap. I can't really think of any more catastrophes, but they're doing great. And then on top of that, the other funny part I really liked is when they're at Care of Magical Creatures and Malfoy is just kind of throwing a fit at having to take care of these blast-ended skewerts, and Hagrid just smiles and is like, well, you know, you can do what you're told, or I can maybe, you know, just take a leaf out of Professor Moody's book. I hear you make a nice ferret, and like the entire Gryffindor class just like dies laughing. And there's some nice moments in this chapter for the kids, especially with starting off with the heaviness of what we do with Sirius. You know, I mean, it's a heavy year for them workload wise for school, but it also seems like there's still some nice joy to be had for them, which is fun.
But we don't get the joy for very long.
No.
Because then we get an owl back from Sirius, and it literally cracks me up because anyone who's been a parent, who knows a parent, who isn't a small kid, 1,000% expected that response of, haha, nice try, Harry.
Yeah. Well, and I love that he gives him instructions, too. He's like, and you need to keep telling me what's going on at Hogwarts, and you need to basically go immediately to Dumbledore if this happens again, you know, kind of thing. Like, and he doesn't say that out loud, but you get that feeling, like, don't forget what I said about your scar. Like, don't, you go to Dumbledore. You remember that last letter? Man, reread it. So I love that. Like, you're absolutely right. It's such a great parent moment.
It really is. It's hilarious too, because you're like, nah, 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 good try, Harry. It's like the first time Harry's parented. Like, we sort of get parenting from the Weasleys, you know, and McGonagall a little bit, but for the most part, you know, they kind of treat him like an adult or like an equal or a student. And this is kind of the first time where it's like, yeah, no, that's not gonna fly. Nope. We're going to try this again, kid. And I just love the moment. It's just, it's comical, but serious. And there it is again. It's literally serious as well. Yeah. So it's good. I really dig it. I dig the small moment we get.
Yeah. No, I agree. And there's another really great, small, funny moment. Because they're talking about, they get a notice at the school there about, you know, when the Triwizard Tournament is going to be starting, when the Bobatons and Durmstrang are going to be arriving. And I love how one of the Hufflepuffs talks about, oh, maybe Cedric. And Harry's like, Diggory. And then Ron's like, that idiot? Hogwarts champion. You know, you can just hear it in his voice. And then Hermione's like, he's not an idiot. You're just mad because he beat you in Quidditch. And he's a really good student and a prefect. And then I love Ron's like, you only like him because he's handsome. And she's like, no.
I don't really like people because they're handsome.
And then he coughs and like, Lockhart.
Yeah. Oh, poor Hermione.
But it's so true.
She did get bested there, if we're being honest.
Yeah. And it, again, it's just, that's a, I feel like she's had, you just have a few of those moments in this chapter where there's just some really fun and funny things that reference other things that have happened either in this book or in the past. And I don't know, it's just, it's, it just tickles me. And I also, on top of that, having the whole castle cleaned in a way that it hasn't been cleaned before. Like, she just talks about how all the portraits are, you know, like, wincing because their faces have been rubbed raw. And it just, like, there's so much whimsy that's happening in this chapter. I just absolutely adore it.
Well, and the whimsy doesn't end when we actually meet the Beauxbatons and the Durmstrang delegations, right? They're actually, I think, more whimsical than we get in the movie. Thank goodness for that. I don't need a full-on dance sequence to introduce me to creative element, but a little unnecessary and a little out of place. So,
yeah, I mean, their arrival with and it's much more exciting because, you know, all the students are actually out there to watch them and to arrive, and the Beauxbatons arrive, of course, in their massive carriage, along with these horses that apparently have hooves the size of dinner plates. Like, when you think of how big that is, that's a massive horse.
It also makes me hungry because it's talking about dinner.
Yeah, and of course they only drink single malt whiskey, which I love. But this was the other interesting thing too, because they talk about Madame Maxime, and what was fascinating to me was the way they describe her is that she is a good-looking woman, and in the movie she's not.
Well, in the movie she still is. She's just ginormous, which she also is here. They didn't make her like obscenely beautiful or anything like that. But
no,
I just felt like the way she's described here
made her feel more beautiful than.
The movie portrayed her as?
Yes.
Sure. Okay. So. That didn't really register with me, but I can see what, you know, they didn't go out of their way to make her like a over-the-top beautiful woman.
Right.
But I still think she's a handsome woman in the movie. And maybe that's a little different from the book here. Mm-hmm. Her accent, however, is spot on.
Yes, it is.
It's the movie, because that's all I could hear while reading this chapter.
Well, and the Durmstrang, you know, Karkaroff is actually very different as well. I mean, he apparently, in the book, he has white short hair with a curling goatee. So he has a different look, because in the movie, he has that long, dark black hair,
like a,
basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's almost like a Death Eater looking
character. So, I mean, he has a completely different look here as well. And then, of course, Crumb is Crumb. It's Crumb. I mean, he's a Durmstrang, so that's huge.
I love that that's like what we end on. It's like, it's Crumb, and then that's the end of the chapter, and you're like, but what happens next?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah. and there's one thing that happens before that, and it's where we reference a couple of things we've talked about before. There's something going on with Fred and George.
Uh-huh.
Because Ron overhears them talking again, and he's like, well, what's going on, guys?
And this time, like, they actually ask about it, which they haven't done before.
And of course, you know, they're like, nothing's wrong other than you. You know, they're being, you know, typical brothers who don't want to talk about what they're doing. So that's just a continuation. And then the last bit of continuation is the fact that you know, Hermione, because they've been so busy, she hasn't had as much time to devote to spew. But when she has, she's been absolutely obnoxious about it to other people. And poor Neville, just bought a badge so she would stop badgering him in the first place. And I love, because we talked about this last week, Fred and George, strangely enough, actually say to her, have you ever actually been to the kitchens? Have you met any of the house elves here? You know, because we've been to the kitchens and they are like, they think this is the best job in the world. And she's like, that's only because they've been brainwashed.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I just, again, I think it's fascinating the way she is discussing this whole thing, because you want to side with Hermione, right? Because that's kind of where we, we come down on those kind of things. But at the same time, every time somebody kind of challenges her on something, her answer is not from firsthand knowledge.
So Hermione is doing the classic thing that I think a lot of, a lot of very genuine and well-meaning people do, and that they take up arms in principle. And I think a lot of us have been there before. Like, in principle, this should be different, or I should have equality, or this sort of thing. And in principle, yes. But in practicality, we have to apply that in a way that works. And again, she's speaking up for a group that hasn't asked her to speak up for them. So she's trying to solve a problem that doesn't exist, based on principle, right? And like, you get the cause is to create equality across, you know, different magical creatures, and that's a very noble cause, but it's also much, much bigger than she is. And it also requires a lot more effort than a fourth year Hogwarts student can kind of put forth. Plus, they don't even really want it. So it's one of those things where I think on principle, she's in the right place and her heart's obviously in the right place. But how we're going to be able to actually execute a vision like that is it's almost impossible until she gets real world experience. She has figured out what she actually can do to help them because, you know, like Winky mentioned, freeing them doesn't help. They don't want that. They don't have a place or anything to go to. We've got to think of new ways to think about this, Hermione, but it is one of those. It was really interesting. I love when Fred and George get real with people, and I like that they do it with Hermione. I've always really liked the relationship between the Weasley twins and Hermione, because I think that they're pretty opposite people, and I love that, you know, they indulge her a little bit, and she knows it comes from a place of goodwill, so she's willing to take it a little bit. So I really like their relationship, and I like the interplay here a little bit, that they're sort of calling her out on something that maybe somebody else wouldn't do.
I agree with you, and I think it is something that really fascinates me to just see, because again, it is something to where there's nothing wrong with having principles and wanting to apply those in places. But I think what we're seeing here is it's coming from a place of not complete knowledge of the entire spectrum of the issue. And I think that Rowling really does a good job here of showing that you need that. And she's showing how Hermione doesn't have that yet. And so, and neither do the readers necessarily either, because she hasn't fully revealed everything yet. And so I think this is something that is going to be fascinating to see, but I also think it's just kind of an important lesson to internalize as well. I mean, especially in the world we live in today, where everybody's trying to stand on certain principles and fight for things, but we kind of see people fighting for things without necessarily always completely understanding every single aspect of things the way they should, and making assumptions about things. And it just goes to show that one should not assume. So I think that's important.
I think everyone's going to get on their soapbox with us this time for that one. Send your complaints.
Yeah, I mean, go ahead. But, you know, I think in the end, it's still absolutely true. So,
I think that they're all valid. I mean, to your point, like they're valid principles and they're valid causes and they're valid concerns. But in this case, there's just a lack of understanding of the depth of it and how to fix it and how to solve it. And, you know, until you have a good solution, the only solution there is not one that they want, you know, like the house elves don't want her solution, which will actually become more and more apparent later in this book. So it's just, you know, it's a true testament that like your heart can be in the right place, but the way that you're executing something or your lack of understanding about it can really be detrimental to mm-hmm. your cause versus researching and understanding and appreciating and come to the table with an educated plan and an educated approach to things and say, no, all the parties involved here, I'm addressing all of our concerns and not just what I think on principle is the best solution. So,
well, and it does seem like the big omission in here is not actually talking to a house elf.
Right.
You know, like it you know, it just seems like that would be your number one thing is to want to go and research by getting to the source, which is those that you think are being oppressed, which are house elves.
Right.
And so,
how many of you guys at work have had, you know, leadership send down something and be like, this is going to solve all the problems. Here's your solution. And you're like, if you ask me, I would have told you this was a terrible idea.
Yeah.
So thanks for that. But if only you'd come and talk to the people that you're solving for, we maybe could have had a better solution, right? Like probably a lot of people can relate to that. So it's sort of the similar situation. She's trying to fix the problem for them, but like she hasn't actually asked them what their problem is or if they have a problem. Mm-hmm. So,
which to me, this is something that I'm really interested to see continue play out, and it's one of the things that will throughout this book, and I think, you know, maybe something we revisit later too in other books. So it really is, I think, the book that begins to slowly kind of change the landscape for the Harry Potter universe in really big ways, and I can't wait to continue on in that. And so you know, we're not quite halfway done with the book, but we're getting closer. There's 37 chapters in the book. So, and next week.
Man, people, we haven't even gotten into it yet.
I know.
Like, no joke. Nope. This is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yes. So much more to come. But, you know, Trey, if anybody wants to talk to you about anything that we were discussing here in the chapter or anything else, where can they find you?
Sure. If you want to come tell me how wrong I am about everything that I've just said, you can find me on Twitter at PCFChick or on Instagram at Drea Kaufman, and it's Kaufman.
And you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02 as well as on Instagram under the same name. I am here on this network also talking about Star Wars with John Mills. We do that every single week over on Aggressive Negotiations. I hope that you will check that out. It's a lot of fun. I'm over on the Trek FM network. I talk about Star Trek Deep Space Nine with Chris Jones over on a show called The Orb. And then I do another show, which is a general geek show where we talk about all the fandoms we love. We don't just, you know, pigeonhole ourselves. We talk about everything we like, which is the 602 Club. And that is a really just a total blast. So I hope you will peruse on over there and check that out. And then last but not least, I do a show called Cinema Stories with my friend Courtney. And we talk about films through the lens of faith. But we really want to thank you for checking your outpost.
Mischief managed.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.